Today is April 7th, 1984. My name is Tika Ward. I am interviewing Bob Douglas. We are in Top House at the Little Loom House, 328 Kenwood Hill Road, Louisville, Kentucky. Bob, you are the president of the board of directors of the Lutate Foundation, Incorporated. I have heard that you first saw Lutate when you were a little boy, right here on these premises.
Yes, when I was youngster, I think maybe 8 or 9 years old, I lived on Kenwood Hill. In fact, I spent most of my life on Kenwood Hill. And before the hill was developed, it was just an open hillside with an exposed top. And we referred to it as Devil's Backbone because it had a lot of Indian arrowheads and relics and fossils. And so all the kids in the neighborhood would run up on top of the hill and play. And I suppose that's what I did one day. And I came over the top of the hill to look at a cave that's immediately above the cabins, and we all spotted the Little Loom houses. I didn't know what they were at that time, and I hadn't known of Lutate, although I later found out my parents knew her very well, what she had been doing for a number of years. And so I came down to the cabins, and I think all of us were invited to do a Little Loom lesson. I don't know what was going on or what day of the week it was, but we all started at that point, and that was my first acquaintance with Lutate and the Little Loom houses. And later, when I went back and told my parents about it, they said, well, of course, you know, she's very well known. It's interesting that you, you know, met her this way. I'm sure I was fascinated with the cabins. It was a new experience for me, coming upon a cabin with someone living in it. And, of course, Lou Tate always, to me, looked like a pioneer lady. And the way she cropped her hair, she wore a smock-type dress and dressed very plainly and very unusual. And I was really taken by the whole experience, and that was my first encounter. And I suppose I had brief encounters. I took weaving lessons that the following summer and did some placemats that I still have and did a few things like that. My sisters took weaving as well. And then later on I went off to school and got involved in other things and moved out of state. And so I was apart from the Loom House maybe 15 years while I was living out of state and went to school. So my first meeting with Lutate was in 1950 or around about that time. Later on, when I graduated from high school and went away to the university to study architecture, I was away from Kentucky for about 15 years, living in other places and doing some traveling. And it wasn't until the early 70s, 1971, when I came back to Kentucky, not knowing whether I would stay or not, that I encountered Lutate at the Kentucky State Fair. She had an exhibit there, a demonstration, as she did many years, on weaving, on textiles and coverlets and so forth. And I just accidentally ran into her, and she asked me if I could help her on the cabin. She knew my architectural background. And innocently enough, I said I would. And so I've been working steadily on that since about 1971, trying to do what I can for the cabins. I suppose the real work of my part of the work was less in weaving and more in what to do with the buildings and more what to do with the cabins to stabilize them, to secure them, because they were in very bad shape. The development of the hillside in the 20 years or so since I'd first met her had caused a lot of erosion and damage and water deteriorating the upper two cabins, its top house and the exterior cabin. And she was concerned about what to do about them and not having money to restore the buildings or to protect them against the erosion, she asked me to become involved. And that's when I approached the city and a number of departments in the city to try to get them to prevent the erosion and the minor mudslides that were happening immediately above the cabins. And I suppose in about 1972 or 73, I learned of the Community Development Agency and the possibility of money being provided to restore the buildings. And I also thought, through the desire she expressed to me, and through talking with others who had helped Lou over the years, that what she really wanted was to be designated a landmark, to have the cabins put on the National Register, or the Kentucky Landmark. And so that's the work that I began in the early 70s. And it wasn't until late in June, I think June 30th of 1975, after several years of pulling together historic data and information from Lutate and from records, that we were designated on June 30th, 1975, to the National Register of Historic Places. And that, to me, was a great step forward. It allowed us to apply for grant money to restore the cabins. We did apply, and we were awarded a $20,000 grant. But over the next year or so, a number of difficulties arose. Lou Tate's health, her emotional condition concerning the ongoing of her work and restoration of the cabins interfered with our ability to complete that project. So we lost the grant. And later on, we continued to work to seek funds from another source. In the interim, after the designation of the Little Wing House to the National Register, we, in effect, took that information that we had worked on for several years and parlayed that into a designation as a Kentucky landmark. And a year later, as a Louisville landmark in April of 76. So after many, many years of worry about what would happen to the cabins or whether or not the work and the cabins would be recognized, it all came together in a very short span of time. So about a year and a half, the cabins were designated both national, state, and local landmark. And this was, I think, a fortunate thing due to Lou Tate's health, that she died just a few years later. So we were able to at least do that much for her, and it made her feel very good. Oddly enough, the National Register appealed to me because I thought that was the leverage we would use to gain the other designations, and it did work. But for her, the Kentucky landmark was the important one. And she had often been called the first lady of folk arts in Kentucky, and she liked that. And she also referred to herself as a living legend. And so having the Kentucky designation was more important to her than the national or even the local designation. So it was good that we were able to do that for her during that time.
After the various designations, the Kentucky Weavers and the Loom House friends continued to patch the cabins back together much the same way that Lou Tate had done and had people do for her over the 40-odd years that she'd been on the Kinver Hill. And we had no funding and no money to do much work with, but we continued to apply for funding from the Community Development Agency, Fiscal Court, and a number of other public agencies. The entire history of the Wing House was one of this personal dedication on behalf of Lou Tate. She literally kept the thing going out of her own funds, her own pocket, and had at no time received any public money or any public funding. So we thought that the only way to solve the problem of restoring the cabins, even though there had long been a preservation fund gathered, $1 for visitors that would go toward preservation of cabins, it wasn't nearly enough to even meet the basic patchwork needs to keep the buildings occupied and useful. So we thought we would have to analyze exactly what it would cost to restore the buildings and to stabilize them against further damage. And so working with various people that I was acquainted with in architectural practice, I was able to put together figures which would estimate the amount of work that would be needed to do to restore the cabin. And it was well over $100,000, which was certainly beyond our grasp. So we decided to take a look at it in terms of perhaps one cabin at a time. In the meantime, before any funding, in fact, came the way of the Lou Tate Foundation, Lou Tate's health deteriorated, first with a heart attack and later with cancer. And when she died on June 2nd, 1979, she left in her will a stipulation that the cabins be turned over to a foundation that might be established to maintain the work of the Little Loom House, primarily the teaching program for children. And if that was possible, then the cabins would be the property of that foundation. If not, she said in her will that she wanted the cabins to go to the government of the United States. We assumed from that she meant the Smithsonian Institution, which had expressed very serious interest in much of her materials and equipment over the years. And we worked at that point to try to establish a foundation so that the properties could be restored and the materials retained in Kentucky rather than in the United States. And so in after her death in 1979, we, her attorneys, Lynch, Sherman, and Cox, called a meeting at the University of Louisville Conference Room and Student Center on September 26, 1979. And there, the Friends of Lou Tate met, and we started the Lou Tate Foundation Incorporated, which held its next meeting the following month in October. The person in charge of establishing the foundation initially was Mr. Arnold Lynch, who was the personal attorney for Lou Tate and had helped on a number of issues late in her life, and maybe 15 or 20 years or so. And he appointed Mr. Earl B. Fowler, an associate in his firm, to work with us in setting up the legal structure for the Lou Tate Foundation. So Mr. Fowler became, after the board was founded, the first executive director of the Lou Tate Foundation. The initial board, or the founding board of the Lou Tate Foundation, consisted of 9 members: Sue Kendrick, John Ryan Jr., Mike Kirk, Vivian Hyatt, Ann Kuiper, Charles Moseley, Thelma Hogan, and Earl Fowler, and myself. And at our meeting in October, I think October 25th of 79, I was elected the president of the Lou Tate Foundation in its first board. And we started immediately developing the Articles of Incorporation and trying to define exactly what it is that the foundation was going to try to do, what our goals and ambitions were. And we generally agreed upon 3 basic things. First of all, we were going to maintain the children's teaching program, which was the vital link throughout the entire history of the foundation. And the thing that was most important to Lou Tate, the whole purpose for having the building house, was to teach the children the art of cloth making and folk history. And so that was our primary purpose, to find a way to do that. Second was to obtain some kind of funding that would allow us to restore the cabins, to stabilize them and maintain the site. And the third was to preserve the very fabulous collection of weaving drafts, antique weaving drafts, and coverlets, which we understood were probably the largest collection of drafts and coverlets in the United States. Subsequent travels, I discovered, even in Canada and various museums throughout the United States, that indeed Lou Tate's collection was the most extensive. And we still have that within the Lou Tate Foundation property. As we continued work as the Lou Tate Foundation Incorporated, we set about to try to meet some of the 3 primary goals that we had developed. And of course, we continued seeking funding, not only to maintain or to stabilize the structures, but to pay a director who might be able to work part-time or full-time on the premises and coordinate all of our efforts. We soon learned that it was easier, at least at that time, to obtain monies for bricks and mortar, so to speak, rather than for funding an agency for the directorship or paying someone to maintain the work of an organization. So we set out in that direction to obtain funds from the community development. With the help of several people at community development and through local landmarks association and some people I'd worked with in architectural office in town, we were able to apply for a $45,000 grant from community development. When we were awarded that grant later in 1980, we were at least on the first leg of restoring the 3 structures. We decided as a foundation that we had 2 possible alternatives. One, the first might be to re-roof all 3 structures and to try to stabilize foundations, or to take $45,000, which was only about a third of the total funding that we needed, take that and restore one of the buildings. And so it was the decision of the foundation, and primarily inspired by the older members, that reminded us that the most important thing was the children's teaching program. And so we elected to take the $45,000 and restore one of the cabins, and that was Top House, where we are today. So the
next job was my working with the executive director to find the appropriate architectural firm to do the work for the cabins. And we interviewed a couple of firms and decided to work with the firm of Ward and Taylor Architects, Jasper Ward, who was well known in the community and had a lot of experience in preservation and restoration work. And the paramount importance in the restoration of the cabin was not to modernize it, not to make it look new, but was to restore it, to stabilize it, to restructure it so we could have another 30 to 50 years of use out of the building without a major maintenance, and yet walk away from the building when it was all over and have a sense that it was unchanged. And this was a very difficult challenge because it not only meant a lot of time-consuming work that many contractors weren't interested in participating in, but also saving the site. In other words, we couldn't have bulldozers and large equipment come up the hillside to do the work, which is the normal way a lot of construction is done. And we had to do a lot of hand work and small work. And so we were fortunate when we did find a contractor after bidding the job and awarding a contract in February of 1982. We had a contractor who's main carpenter contractor also had a son and daughter who were good at working on construction and had experience, and so it was a family affair. The three of them primarily did most of the work, except for plumbing and electrical work. So all the carpentry work, and that was the major portion of the work at the top house, was done by a family of three. So it worked very well, and they were careful to protect the trees and the many thousands of bulbs and plantings that we take to put on the hillside over the years. And it took a long time. It took almost a year before the work was completed. And it's interesting if to see the photographs of the work during the construction, because we literally took the cabin apart and discovered many interesting and frightening things about the weakness of the structure. And so we spent a lot of energy and time below the surface, so to speak. A lot of the money and effort was spent restructuring the building to have the same profile that it always had, the same outward appearance, but to completely restructure it internally. The cabin had originally three separate small rooms on the main floor and a lower porch down on the downhill side of the building, and it had no basement. It had just a mud swamp underneath it. It had originally not been a closed-in foundation. So we put in a new foundation, and we were able to create a workroom on the lower level and restore the porch. And we took the partitions out of the upper level of the cabin and made one large room. We retained the old floor and restored and repaired it where it was necessary, and retained as much of the old structure as possible. But in so renovating into one space, we elected to open the ceiling or expose the truss structure which held up the roof, and this gave the top house cabin, the main workroom, we thought more flexibility in the use of the number of groups and how many people we could get in here at one time, because we knew that we could no longer use it in quite the same way that Lee Tate had used it over the years. It had earlier been a summer cabin, so these were small rooms with bedrooms in effect and a kitchen, and so we turned it into one large workspace that has a contemporary flavor on the inside, but we think suitable to the nature of the structure and its setting. But the outside is essentially the way it was when it was constructed in about 1896. Wisteria Cabin, which we are anxious to work on, it needs much the same kind of work the top house did, was built in about 1895. And Lower House, which we refer to as the Little Loom House, and we have since learned that Lee Tate referred to it as Esta Cabin, was the oldest cabin. It was built in 1870. Being the first structure, it was the caretaker's house and office for a rock quarry, which the quarry was above the cabins on the hillside, and much of the foundation rock for the Third Street, Strawberry Lane, a number of roads in South Louisville came from this rock quarry. In addition to being concerned about the internal structure of the building and installing a toilet and so forth and plumbing, which the building had never had previously, we were interested in maintaining the exterior appearance of the structure, the board and batten, vertical board and batten siding, much of it, the original oak, about 1.25 inches thick, which was cut from trees on Kinlick Hill. In fact, all of the cabin structure, all three, were cut from native timber, native oak from Kinlick Hill. The cabins were visited by a very famous architect, Frank Lloyd Wright, in 1940. He came to Louisville for a convention at the Institute of Architects and visited a number of sites in Louisville. He came to the Wing House and took photographs of the buildings and later referred to them as board and batten summer houses set in the dignity of nature. And this was a quotation that Lou Tate really took to heart and used a great deal over the years. And so among the number of illustrious visitors that came to the Wing House, the architect Frank Lloyd Wright was here and felt that it was probably one of the nicest things that he saw on his visit to Louisville. Of course, his philosophy was to work with the natural site, and of course these buildings did just that. They originally were perched on poles and had no foundations and set above the ground, and they had a natural weathered appearance. They were unpainted, and they blended very well into the hillside. And that's what we sought to maintain as much as possible and still make them contemporary in our ability to use them. Also during the restoration, when we took the attic out in order to restructure the roof and install the new trusses, we discovered a skylight, a light on the north side of the cabin, and we're not sure why the light was in the attic space, because it was unused attic, it was unfinished attic, and very small, you couldn't stand up in the attic. But it was one of the things we left and incorporated very well into the contemporary interior of Top House Cabin. In fact, all of the windows and door openings that now exist in the cabins are original to the cabin. And consequently, when you're in this one large room, you see various sized windows at various locations and various shapes, a very odd arrangement, to be sure, if it were one room originally. And so when the visitor visits today, they will see the same windows and have the same views that people apparently have had since 1896. We've also installed, we thought in keeping with the nature of the building and with the attitude that we think Lou Tate had toward the buildings and the site, a wood stove, which does a very good job of heating the cabins. And we think it's in keeping with the structure of the building. So these things are new. A lot of concern with energy conservation today led us to decide, in addition to the use of a heat pump, which is a contemporary device, we'd also use the closed wood stove. And so we now have that in our Top House room. Now that Top House has been stabilized and restored, and we've spent $45,000, we estimate a need for approximately $45,000, $50,000 to restore Wisteria Cabin, which happens to be my favorite cabin. It gets its name because of the large Wisteria vine that's in the front of the cabin. And it was originally built very much like the old Kentucky dog trot type cabins, or two-bin cabins, two-pin cabins, a room on either side of a breezeway. And in this instance, it was not really built out of logs, but built out of board and batten timbers from the hillside here. Very lightweight structure, and the dog trot, or the breezeway, portion between the two major rooms was enclosed on both ends with French doors and glass, so that it's a very pleasant place to be. You can open the doors and get a nice breeze through there. And originally, this is where a lot of people would choose to sleep during the summer months, because the air could move through the cabin. It's the one I remember most, or best, from the time I first encountered the little loom houses. And so I'm very anxious to see that building restored. And later we hope to restore the home where Lou Tate lived, that's the Lohr House, or some people refer to it as the little loon house itself, and she referred to it as Esta Cabin. It is probably the most substantial of the three buildings, and we're hoping that time will allow us to restore the wisteria and then later go on to the work that we feel we have to do on the lower house. Luke felt that Wisteria Cabin offered an opportunity for South End or local artists, or anyone from this area, to exhibit their work. It's a gallery-type space, although quite small. This would offer an opportunity for someone to display their work and to have meetings. And this is the kind of thing we would like to see done with the various civic clubs and garden clubs and so forth. Might have a place to meet in the South End so that we could share the site, as Lou Tate always did, with all people in the neighborhood. The cabins have long been a part of the history of Louisville, and particularly of South Louisville, from 1870 onward. A number of people have owned the property prior to Lou Tate's mother buying the buildings in 1939. And interestingly enough, after the original use as a rock quarry, and later, 20-some-odd years later, when these upper two cabins were built for summer houses, the property has always been maintained by people interested in the arts, not just folk arts, but in writing, in painting, and in music, and in teaching. And a number of people have been well-known in the area for their work in the arts. Mary Wolfe, Lou Tate's mother, and a number of interesting people have visited the cabins over the years prior to ownership by Lou Tate. The St. Mark's Lutheran Church, which is located in South Louisville, first held a meeting at the Little Loon House and founded that church and later moved out to their own building. The Happy Birthday song that everyone is aware of and knows of was first sung at the Little Loon House in the lower cabin. In addition to that, a number of the previous owners, Etta Hast and others, held meetings, weekly meetings, where they invited a number of writers and painters and artists and so forth to come and visit and talk about their work. And so I think it's appropriate that later on, when Lou Tate's mother purchased the buildings and left them to Lou Tate to use for weaving, that these buildings have played such a key role in the artistic history of this community, not just South End, but Louisville as well. And from this point, then Lou Tate became very widely known throughout the United States and, in fact, internationally for her work in weaving and in textiles. Oddly enough, it was almost by accident that she became involved in this, because she primarily was interested in history and had studied at Berea College in Kentucky, and later at the University of Michigan, where she worked on a master's degree in history. And there was a professor who suggested to her that she do a paper on weaving and textiles, because she had gone to Berea and because she was from Kentucky. And so she did that. And it coincided at that time in the late 30s with the Depression and the need for people to be able to have cottage industry or home kind of work in order to make up a meager living. And so it was, a situation where the right person came together at the right time to seize the opportunity. She did so with the support of President Mrs. Hoover, and later with President Mrs. Roosevelt, because they were very much interested in knowing more about the opportunities in folk arts and how people in the mountains, particularly in the Appalachian region, who were well below the poverty line, might have an opportunity to earn some kind of income from the artwork they did, and also stimulate interest in native folk and artwork of the United States. And so all these things came together in the late 30s, and so in 1938, Lou Tate had been asked to see what she could do about developing a small loom. And she worked with Bob McKnight and Dr. Mather, who literally helped her build the first little loom, which might be more portable and transportable
and would not occupy so much place in the room of a house as the old floor rooms had done previously. And so working with these two and with Mrs. Hoover, she began to work with the Little Women to develop a program for Girl Scouts and for young people to learn something about the folk art of weaving. After the first loom was built in 1938, it underwent a number of refinements, both to improve its appearance and to make it a stronger unit.
This is the end of Side 1 with Bob Douglas. This is Side 2 of the April 7th, 1984 interview with Bob Douglas in Top House.
Later refinements of the small loom were made to make the unit a stronger unit so the children that use it would not destroy, literally destroy the loom, which the earlier versions didn't hold up so well. And so Mr. Sam Kendrick, husband of Kendrick, who was a cabinet maker and worked at Kimmel Brothers locally, elected to use a hard rock maple material, which is very, very sturdy, and we have, of course, many of these blooms still today, that he refined and, in a sense, re-engineered. In addition to that, he built a special loom table, which is collapsible so it can be stored or carried about, with various pedals that would allow you to attach foot pedals to the various harnesses of the looms. The little looms were primarily two harness and four harness looms. And so the foot pedals would allow you to change the frames as you were using your hands to run the shuttle and weave. He also designed a bench, a very simple maple bench that would go through the whole with the entire piece of equipment, the loom, the table, and the stool. We have many of these today. Now, the last 125 looms that were made before Lou Tate's death were later, after her death and when the foundation had formed, were assembled by Mr. Roy Heimerdinger, who was a cabinet maker to the foundation, and worked very hard and generously to put these things together for us. And so we have looms that are maybe as much as 40-odd years old, and looms which are relatively new, and they all sit side by side in the loom house. Some are painted various colors. At some points throughout the history of loom house, we chose to make some of the looms colorful, so you might find some looms that are green and blue and robin egg blue and red and yellow. So the children like this. This was part of the entire teaching program, or the idea, as we take for the little loom house. Even though she was a weaver and a master weaver and was sought for opinions on weaving throughout the world, she was by nature and by training a historian. And so when you came to Little Loom House as a child, you not only learned something about the simple mechanism of weaving, very simple patterns or primary cloth, as I might call it, but you learned a great deal about the history, not only of the loom house and the loom, but you learned something about this hill, which the Indians had earlier called Sunshine Hill. And so you would hear stories from Lou Tate about the various wild animals on the hill, the bobcat, you had a bobcat skin that she had hung on the wall. And this is, of course, fascinating to children. And she would tell us stories about the red foxes and the wolves that were on the hillside when she first came out in 39. In fact, during the construction of the cabin, the reconstruction of the Top House cabin, we ran a little red fox out of the stereo cabin. So we know that, you know, these things did in fact exist on the site, and they weren't just little tales that Lou had made up for the children's benefit. But she told a lot about the history of the Indians, how they used the hillside, and the Sunshine Hill, because the top of the hill was generally exposed, much the same way the Iroquois Hill, which is now Iroquois Park, was referred to as Burnt Knob, because the top of the hill, or the top of the knobs, part of the chain of the knobs, or the Western Knobs, the geographical definition for the bluegrass area of Kentucky, that's how they got their names. And so the Indians used the hillside as a way of looking out for game that would run through the valleys at the base of the hills. And so with what is generally thought of now as Kinwood Hill Road was a buffalo trace, or a way that the buffaloes would move between the hills to various watering places, and the Indians would be on the hill and look out for the herds coming through and be able to come down and shoot them, and or spear them with their arrows. And so, you know, this was a part of what you learned at the Little Loom House, and it was an irresistible temptation for Lou to teach this and tell this along with the weaving. So you came away with a lot more than just a piece of cloth and not how to weave a very simple fabric. She, I think, appropriately was referred to as folk art first lady in Kentucky, because she really did talk about the history of the state and about folk art, and not just about weaving. Even the simple kindergarten loom, which she developed for very, very young children, had large strips of fabric that she placed a gauze white tape on the back. And on the back, she would write the color of the fabric, if it had a pattern, the pattern, the name of the person whose clothing it came from, the age of the person, something about them. So that even as a young child, weaving this in a very simple pot holder type loom, you learn something about color, about pattern, and about the history of the person whose clothing this came from. So this kind of teaching was very, very important to her. This is the sort of thing that we probably found the most difficult thing about maintaining the concept or the idea of the Little Loom House the way Blue Tate did it. Even though almost everything we do is permeated with her thoughts and feelings and our remembrances of her and her desires, this is the sort of thing that we believe finally that can't really capture in an organization the way that you can with an individual. So we inevitably have had to face certain changes, and we've had to respond to the needs of the day, and keeping in mind as much of the historical aspect and the idea of the living house as possible. The thing that we do lack today that we had before, maybe didn't realize it, was this special kind of person who could take such a complete and total interest in what they were doing. For 40 years, Lou Tate was on this hillside, and this literally was her life. Every aspect of her life focused on the Little Loom House and everything that went on here. And of course, we're faced, as friends and acquaintances of Lou Tate and of weaving, with the prospect of living other lives and doing other things and taking as much time as we can to further the work that she's began. But this is the one thing that we have not been able to capture, even though we've been able to save some of the buildings and much of the material. We hope that there are people in our organization who might be persuaded at a later time when we can receive funding for a directorship, a person paid to do this work, who have the potential for being the kind of teacher that Lou Tate was. And so we keep bits and pieces and articles about Lou Tate all around the cabins to remind people who had not met her during her lifetime what this whole thing is about. And so it was not just a loom that she developed, and it was not just cabins that she maintained, but it was the idea, as she referred to it as the Little Loom House idea. And she thrived off of working with young children. I think we all agree that once we pass the age of about 15, she considered us adults, former children, and we then became workers for her. And this is the one way she survived, quite literally, by working with young people and bringing them up. And we'd all go away for a number of years and do different things, and then slowly trickle back. And that's how she kept the whole thing going. And we realized that if, as a foundation, we were going to maintain ourselves over a similar period of time, that we're going to have to do the same kind of thing. And so we're more and more focusing our efforts on trying to introduce younger people to the Loom House, and this year has been very good about bringing Girl Scout and Boy Scout troops and school children in great numbers back to Bloom House. This is the basic idea and really our primary goal, teaching. Lou Tate's real teaching program began perhaps as early as 1935, 1934, for history paper on weaving, letter to be a part of the National Committee on Folk Arts. She was asked to be represented by Mrs. Hoover, and she was asked to design a show, Folk Arts in Kentucky. This was held in New York and in Washington, D.C., and her earlier acquaintance with Mrs. Roosevelt was renewed at this exhibit. Mrs. Roosevelt visited to see, and once again became interested in the idea of creating a small loom and to use for teaching people the art of weaving, the folk weaving. And it was through these educational interests of both Mrs. Hoover and Mrs. Roosevelt that the small loom was developed, and the idea of the loom house, the concept of the loom house, that is continuing the art of weaving and conveying and sharing the knowledge of hand weaving was born. In 1936, Mrs. Hoover wanted a program to be developed for the Girl Scouts and asked Lou Tate to work out that program. And later on, with the development of a small, inexpensive loom, Lou Tate had blueprints printed so that others might be able to build their own loom. Lou, throughout her life, had no particular interest in amassing a great fortune or profiting from her work, and so she freely made these things available in the early years. And so working with Bob McKnight and Dr. Mather, she had a plan drawn which suggested how the loom might be made and assembled. And it was mentioned by Mrs. Hoover in a national newspaper article, and immediately the table was besieged with over 700 requests for blueprints. And this is really how, in the early years, the whole idea of the loom house, of the loom, the little loom, was spread across the country. At a reception at the White House, Mrs. Hoover was introducing Lou Tate in the reception line, and a number of times stumbled over her name, which I only later learned was Louisa Tate Bowsman. I'd always known her as Lou Tate, and later on as Lou. But her real name was Louisa Tate Bowsman, and Mrs. Hoover kept trying to pronounce this name as she introduced her in the reception line, and stumbled over the name a number of times and said, I'll not call you by that name anymore. And from now on, you will be just plain Lou Tate. And so I've always enjoyed that story, and hope someday that the foundation might put together some book on Lou Tate which might bear that name. This was really how Lou Tate was born, quite literally, with Mrs. Hoover. Her name was born. And many people throughout her lifetime referred to her as Miss Tate or Lou Tate, and she never bothered to correct anyone. And she was very taken by being referred to as Lou Tate by Mrs. Hoover. Later on, through her work on the National Committee on Folk Arts in the mid-30s, she also became acquainted with a very important local person, Hattie Bishop Speed, who visited the exhibit in Washington and met Lou Tate and suggested that Lou develop a similar exhibit to be presented at the very newly opened Speed Museum in Louisville, which now sits on the campus of the University of Louisville. And so Lou, very early on in her career, was fortunate to meet with very illustrious people, people in a position to help spread the word and help encourage the work that she was working in. And her exhibit then at the Speed Museum, I think two or three years after the opening of the Speed, was one of the first one-woman show, you might say, that was held at the Speed Museum. Part of the interest in Lou's teaching interest and ability was based upon the fact that she had, for a number of years, gathered weaving drafts. These are patterns, or so to speak, blueprints of how various weaving patterns are made and laid out on the loom, how you would warp the loom, the thread count and pattern count, that she was very, very knowledgeable of. And she spent her entire life seeking copies or original drafts. And we had thousands, quite literally thousands, of weaving drafts or weaving patterns that were made over 150, 200 years of American history. And fortunately enough, another situation being in the right place at the right time, a lot of the Scottish, English, Irish immigrants to the United States settled in the Ohio River Valley and brought with them their textile art and their weaving background, and with many of them, their patterns. And one time we take, in fact, developed a booklet on Scottish tartans, entirely on Scottish tartans, which of course was great interest to me. But she also collected weaving drafts that were on the backs of wills and on summonses and tax notices and any bit of paper. In fact, she even has one weaving draft on the back of a leaf, a large leaf, which she collected from people who brought them to her, sent them to her, and once they were aware that she was looking for this kind of thing. So there's a wealth of historical pattern in weaving that she collected, and these were her real valuable things. Throughout her life, she denied herself numerous opportunities to become wealthy in the normal sense of the word, and to have many things and material possessions, but she chose to do her work here and continue that. I've often wondered on a personal level whether it was an artistic decision on her part or simply accepting as a matter of fate her opportunity, her early experiences with these important people getting her started somehow helped her to commit an entire lifetime of work to this endeavor with very little financial reward and a good deal of hardship because of lack of money to live a more comfortable life. But she did have many, many valuable things in these weaving drafts and wonderful coverlets, which on a purely monetary basis might bring several hundreds of dollars, or in some instances thousands of dollars each, by any number of museums would freely pay that kind of money for them. She collected them and maintained them, and people over the years then would bring coverlets to her and say, well, this came from this attic and this place and my grandmother and my great-grandmother and so forth. And so along with a lot of these patterns or stories of where they came from, who gave this information to her. So she might have a bit of an old coverlet or a remnant of an old coverlet, or simply a photograph and a drawing that she made, a draft that she would make based on the pattern of that particular coverlet. And many of these were very individual. Earlier on, they, particularly the Scottish tartans and so forth, were based on the clan tartans, but later on they were very individual, and it was what the particular weaver might choose to do. And so that might be that particular weaver's pattern. And so a lot of the drafts are maybe one-time kind of things that were very personal to the people who did the weaving. I've been fortunate enough to travel in the last few years and have, I'm not sure because of my boom house experience or just by my natural interest, have made a part of my travel include knowing something about local textiles and bringing back samples of things and blankets and so forth from other countries, and both visiting in Scotland, England, Ireland, and more recently in Canada. In fact, I visited Canada prior to the UK's death, to Nova Scotia and to Cape Breton, and met with a lady there, Florence Mackley, who was considered the foremost person in folk art, and particularly in textiles, in Canada. And who had corresponded over a number of years with Lou Tate and knew her very well. We worked together on several books. Who freely acknowledged to me that Lou Tate was far and away superior in knowledge to herself in terms of coverlet patterns and textiles and drafts and some of the old weaving things. In fact, Lou was asked by the Canadian government to decipher from remnants of old cloth from a French fort in Cape Breton what the fabric was and how it might be reproduced to make new uniforms to outfit the various people who would inhabit this restored French fortification. And so even though they had a very important person right under their nose, quite literally, they came to Lou Tate to find out how they might reweave this kind of fabric today to have a similar appearance and how they might achieve the original color, which of course at that time came from various natural dyes. And I know part of the experience of the Bloom House, for young people always included, at least once a year or so, the entire process of cloth making. And I recall instances where sheep were brought to the Little Loom House, were sheared right on the premises, the wool cleaned, spun, dyed, and later woven. This is a thing now that the Kentucky State Fair, perhaps a number of other fairs in this area, have taken on that challenge of going through the entire process of cloth making. And in fact, they have speed contests at the State Fair to determine who can do this process most quickly and come up with the best product at the end. So we, who knew Lou Tate as students, had the entire experience from sheep to the final product. This was an important experience to know where things come from and how they come about. And Lou Tate was wonderful to being able to convey that sort of thing. So you learn so much more than just weaving. You learn a lot about how people lived, the various things they had to do to accomplish the things they did and have the things that they needed, both necessity and for luxury. Also, on my travel to Canada, I was surprised. As you so often do, take people that you know for granted and maybe don't have a full appreciation for their work and their worth in general, at large. Happened to mention that I knew Lou Tate and worked with a little loom house in Louisville to a number of weavers at an exhibit in Cape Breton. And the room literally came to a hush when I mentioned her name because they knew, as weavers, just how important a person she was. And that was probably one of my first inclinations that I had known someone and lived literally on the other side of the hill from someone who had made such an impact internationally in weaving. And all of us who knew her later on as Lou had a hard time always appreciating that because we knew her at all levels, as children, as young adults, and later as older adults, and who worked with her literally from cleaning windows and sweeping floors and waxing this and that, assembling looms, carting things off to exhibits for her. And we saw her at all times and at all moods. And this was part of the total loom house experience. I don't know whether it was the little loom house idea or not, but this is part of what we all knew about Lou. And so it was very hard to appreciate and to gain the proper perspective on just how important she was. And I think we all agree that she was a very special kind of person. And it's, as I have said earlier, it's probably the most difficult challenge to restore that aspect to the building houses. Lou may have been dubbed the just plain Lou Tate, but I learned in the years that I was acquainted with her that she was, in fact, a very complex individual. And there were many aspects of her personality and nature that I didn't learn until I was an adult. And very interesting and memorable events, which I perhaps don't remember all the details about, but I know that one experience I had was the first time that I literally set foot in the lower house, and it wasn't until actually the moment that I entered that I realized that I had never been in the house before. I'd known her all these years, and I suppose just my own sense of privacy or her very private nature, in fact, I learned only later from other people, very few people had in recent years been in her home or in the lower cabin where she lived. But it was a very interesting experience to know that. It was, in fact, I felt privileged to be asked or invited in to where she really did her work. She spent many, many long hours in the evening and had eccentric work habits, working all night, literally, on research work for various colleges and universities that she corresponded with about weaving matters, about history. A number of them include Rice University and several colleges in Ohio who were constantly asking her to come and join their faculty and be a part of them, and they offered her many lures to take her away from the cabins and from the Lublin House. I think toward the end of her life, when she was frustrated with a number of difficulties that she had to deal with, physical difficulties personally and with the buildings, she was probably tempted to do so. And on occasion, when she did not feel up to par, it reminded some of us who worked very closely with her on a day-to-day basis that she, in fact, was going to do that if we didn't help her in a better way than we had. These were things that many of us just took in stride in realizing that they were just frustrations being expressed or concerns being expressed, and we really never gave serious thought to the notion that she might take her things away or might, in fact, leave this hillside. I think we knew as well as she did that, you know, this was her place to be, and she was going to stay here to the last moment. But on seeing her house, her personal area, for the first time, I was, you know, surprised to discover a number of things about her. She had, despite the fact that you could walk into any of the cabins and see hundreds of linens and hundreds, maybe thousands of pages and papers and yarns and skeins and things everywhere, literally, in what seemed to be a random or haphazard pattern, that she was, in fact, quite orderly in her thinking and in her total ambition for the Little Loom House, that literally everything she did focused on the Little Loom House. And so what might at first appear to be physical disorder, in fact, did have an underlying structure and a purpose that, as we all grew up and knew her better, realized that she had internally, and it was a project that we had as friends to try to extract this order, this sense of order, purpose, and everything she did. And that was a very secretive aspect of her personality. And so once having seen her home in this maze of paper and looms and yarns and so forth that she literally nested among, I was surprised to find that there was an underlying structure and purpose to everything she did. She spent her morning hours with visitors who would literally come from all parts of the United States, having known something about the Loom House and the tape, would come for a visit spontaneously, very often unannounced, and she was always making herself available to unannounced visitors. She then spent her personal time working on research and historic documentation of weaving patterns with various colleges and universities late into the evening. I always thought it was very humorous that this so-called pioneer lady, the way I viewed her, would have a stack of, you know, dime mystery novels, paperback novels beside her bed, but she really feasted on these things at the late hours when she couldn't sleep very well after she had finished her work. She also could be seen in the corner of her very small kitchen, which was piled high with looms and papers and pages, as she referred to them, of weaving information that she had written. Her kitchen, incidentally, consisted of a sink, a very small refrigerator, and a hot plate. It was very, very meager living, and she thrived, we often wonder how, off of TV dinners that she would put on this hot plate, and she would, you know, eat it very irregular odd hours of the day and night. But she would set it at this very small typewriter, portable typewriter, that sat on the loom stand in front of her kitchen, among all this, what appears to be initially, at first instinct, debris, and work on these research papers that she sent out all over the country, and all the pages that some of the foundation members have spent several years now sorting through pages about weaving and all aspects of weaving that she was interested in, and weaving drafts, sending up literature to universities as well as personal friends, weavers, and others that are interested in Newhouse work. I always felt that this aspect of her nature was a very curious thing, because when she emerged from her house, she took on a different atmosphere and attitude. And whenever there were open houses, seemed very reserved and content not to be the focal point of attention. She, in fact, would immediately make the youngest child available as a focal point of her attention, and therefore everyone else's attention was focused on a child at a loom or a child at a spinning wheel. This was her way of, you know, letting all of us know, I think, what the purpose of the loom house was all about. And so her personal work was really, and the important work that she did, was put aside to these small hours of the morning, where she would set up this portable typewriter and type all night in many instances, and a cigarette hanging out the corner of her mouth is another thing we didn't see about her in a public way when she worked with the children. She was a little freer in her nature when she worked with the adults, and part of the experience was to have pink lemonade, which we often would spike after visitors would leave.
This is the end of side two. Today is April 7th, 1984. My name is Tika Ward. I am with Bob Douglas, and we are at Top House at the Little Loom House, 328 Kenwood Hill Road, Louisville, Kentucky. Our topic is the history of Lou Tate and the Little Loom House, and we are now going to take a walking tour of the grounds.
We're now on the porch of Top House, the top porch, which was added to the original structure in about 1955. It is made up of a number of window sizes. They're actually storm windows that were gleaned from leftovers of building projects, friends that Lou Tate knew, and a carpenter she knew who assembled all this and enclosed the porch. It now houses a number of walking wheels and various other spinning wheels and weaving paraphernalia. Lou used this very often as a workplace, a summer office, so to speak. The walls along the glass and the back wall were lined with bookcases and shelves, open shelves, very simple board shelves, where she had thousands of pages that she had written stacked. And she could work from this vantage point and look down the hill and see Wisteria Cabin and the lower house, Esther Cabin, and see any visitors that might show up unexpectedly. So this was a good working place for her, and it was, in effect, her public office. This is where she liked to meet people. And Top House, not only today is the main activity center, but has always been the main focal point of the three room house cabins. I think if we go downstairs now and out onto the gravel area in front of the cabin, we can see where
most of the open house events were held throughout the years.
Like so many other things that were done at the Loon House, the gravel was donated by friends and people who worked in the little Loon House community, and over the years built up this area of sort of a terrace on the hillside immediately below this cabin. And these picnic tables that we're now standing in front of are very similar to picnic tables that Lou Tate had out in this area for visitors to use and for the Loon House people to use. Most of the events took place during the summer months because the cabins were unheated through many of the years that I experienced the Loon House. And so most of our activity took place outdoors and in the summer months. In fact, there's a privy just over the hillside here, which until just recently was actively used by visitors to the Loon House. These tables are new tables built by a friend and sculptor, husband of Sally Moss, who is now the executive director of the Little Loon House. He constructed these tables for us as part of our restoration of the Top House cabin. As you look back at Top House, you'll see the wooden batten structure, which is very much the way it has always been, although we had placed on it a coat of preservative stain to even out the color between the new boards that had to replace the rotted old boards and the old boards. But it essentially looks the way it did for many, many years, certainly since the 50s. The many open house activities that took place on this gravel terrace not only included the annual spring and summer open house events that we held each year, but it also was the place where the designation ceremony took place, designating the Loon House as a Louisville landmark. And now just to the right of the lower door to the Top House is a plaque signifying a Louisville landmark. The plaque that is on the wall now reads 1975, and it is not the original plaque. The original plaque was given in 1976. But either through vandalism or through accident, was damaged and cracked. We've saved that, but as a part of the restoration ceremony for the Top House, we wanted to install another plaque. And so the local landmarks people had available a plaque that was 1975. And so we put that one up. So that's part of the inconsistent history of the Little Loon House, but it's very much part of what we've all come to know to be the Loon House. From this terrace, you can, even at this time of year, begin to see hundreds and hundreds of daffodils and bulbs and spring flowers that are starting to emerge through the leaves. No one really has an accurate count of how many flowers and bulbs were planted on the hill. It probably numbers in the thousands. But they were done in interesting rows, very much like the contour of land, which is quite irregular. So over this half-acre site, you'll see maybe thousands of daffodils and dionysus and various early spring flowers started blooming. Not too long from now, the natural native redbud trees and some of the dogwood trees will start blooming around Easter time. And then later on, of course, the huge old oak trees, some as old as 300 years or so, will start providing a canopy for the Loon House. In fact, midsummer, it's very hard to find the cabins, except that you look for small woods on this hillside. And most of the adjoining property owners have built since the 50s and have generally cleared their land, although it's still somewhat wooded. But it's very easy to spot the little Loon House once the trees are full deep. The cabin that is immediately below the Top House, and we'll walk down there. Roadway, which was part of the original oxen trail that came from a rock quarry down to the base of the hill. This next cabin is the Wisteria Cabin. Many people like this cabin. There are many great photographs available of activities going on in front of Wisteria Cabin. It's essentially just two large rooms and a small shed room
the upper side of the hill. And of course, the central dog trot breezeway space has been enclosed with glass.
The Wisteria Cabin is in considerable disrepair at this point, and yet it still has much the same character that it had when it was originally constructed. The board and batten style of building, which was a cottage style. The boards are 1¼ inches thick. They're cut from the native oak on this hillside. There is one chimney on the upper hillside room which has three different clay chimney pots on it. And this is the only room in this cabin that has any indication of how it might have been heated. There is a fireplace in that room. And so we only imagine that it might have also have been a kitchen, or the little shed structure on the north hill or upper hill side of the cabin. It might have been a very small kitchen to prepare a light meal when it was a summer house. We hope that this building will be used by the community later on once we have an opportunity to restore it. We found many, many documents and valuable papers stored in the attic of this structure. And this is the same one where we've seen a red fox, a number of other squirrels and local creatures running in and out pretty freely. The cabin right below is an Esta cabin. It's the little loon house, or Lou Tate's home. On the uphill side of the cabin is a small lean-to kitchen, and this was the kitchen where I referred to earlier that Lou Tate did her work doing the research and the papers and typing up the many hundreds of pages that she wrote over the years. And just winding along the sidewalk, you can still see all of the spring flowers coming into bloom. This cabin is also covered with board and batten style, and originally was a vertical log, a split log structure, so it's a good deal more sturdy than the other two cabins. It's the oldest in 1870, and has many curious shaped and oddly placed windows around all the walls of the cabin. Early on in some of our foundation work, we elected to remove small stair and kind of a landing way, so to speak, that extended out from the stairway to the second floor, which had been added in the late 1800s to provide, allow for our caretaker who lived in this building to go freely without interfering with the office that was in the lower level of the house, or the main room of this cabin. The cabin is made up essentially of kitchen, a small area which now includes a bath, a hall for the second level, but one large room with a massive stone fireplace which has mud mortar and joints and a large iron arm where cooking surely was done over the years. I don't know if Kate ever did that, but I suppose she did. One of the features of an open house, in addition to the lemonade, was we all bring potluck or bring a covered dish for you, just to cut it. And she always liked to have that after the guest would leave, the friends of the family also join together and have supper. And so I'm sure in the early years, when she used what later became her permanent home, when she had guests there before leaving, they might well have used a fireplace for their feeding and maybe for cooking. The cabin, even though it's in a deteriorated state, it's relatively unchanged from its original beginning, except for the wooden batten, the mineral and some of the other things I'm sure the way they were. Originally, for example, a post is a portion of the stairway leading to the second floor, which is literally a tree. I doubt that it was grown there, but no attempt to turn it into a timber, as I saw it, it should have been away. Since it's a cedar post, it now is exposed. Now that the